what is your fear that in 5 years, what the U.S. will become?
We'll have no freedom. We won't be allowed to worship the God that we love. Our children will be taught lies in school. We will be spied on, and we will have no more freedom.
Freedom. What makes you free? What keeps you free? What is your idea of freedom, and does it comport with mine? Does it matter? Seems like freedom, especially in recent years, has become more of a buzzword than an actual reality. Now, I feel free. I feel like generally I live in a pretty free society, but my idea of freedom is not the same as my conservative counterparts. Let's deconstruct this. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 172. My name is Melvin. Thank you so much for being here. Now, I am a liberal, and that's a word that I like using, and it's not a word that I'm necessarily ready to run away from just yet. When I first began listening to conservative talk radio and watching conservative television shows, I noticed that the word liberal came up a lot, and it was demonized, so much to the point that I began to ask myself, perhaps I don't know what that word means. If I have a liberal amount of money, seems like I have a lot of money. If I have a liberal amount of ice cream, seems like I have a lot of ice cream. If I have a liberal-sized house, it seems to me that would be a pretty big house. But the way I heard it talked about when I would listen to conservatives was liberal was perhaps the worst thing in the world to be.
We're here to protest because... I don't really know a whole lot about politics being a teenager, but what I do know and stuff like that, and I mean, it's going to affect everybody because, like, for example, the healthcare, I know that...
The healthcare, yes.
The healthcare, if they give it out for free, that means that even the teachers, and when all the teachers have been complaining about their pay and stuff like that, and even the teachers, that means that their salary is going to go down even more, and there's going to be less teachers, and then it's going to affect me in school and stuff like that.
It seems that you can't have a vibrant democracy if you don't have an educated public, an educated populace. And if you're upset about the government, you're upset about the way things are going, but you don't really know the way that things are going, you don't understand how economies work, you don't understand how we got to where we're at, and you don't understand anything about economics, perhaps you should just step back a little bit and learn. The word liberal, as I understand it, is more of a progressive ideology. But what is a neoliberal? Neoliberal is not a phrase that we use in America anymore. It's something that we used at one time, back in the 30s and 40s, but not long after that, the word began to die. So if I'm a liberal and that's a progressive, what is a neoliberal? Wouldn't that be more of a new liberal? Maybe like a super liberal? Perhaps I should be wearing a cape if I'm a neoliberal, but no. That's not at all what it is. And here's the problem. We don't use the word neoliberal. And what has replaced the word neoliberal? Well, amongst those who are neoliberals, nothing. And that's part of the problem. Because its anonymity is both a symptom and a cause of its power. Neoliberalism is trickle-down economics, or what we sometimes refer to as Reaganomics. So that's what progressives call it. And conservatives call it nothing. There's a great article over at The Guardian's website by a man named George Monbiot from back in April. And it's titled Neoliberalism, the Ideology at the Root of All of Our Problems. And it first points out that inequality in neoliberalism is recast as virtuous. Because it says the market ensures that everyone gets what they deserve. Quote, neoliberalism sees competition as the defining characteristic of human relations. It redefines citizens as consumers whose democratic choices are best exercised by buying and selling, a process that rewards merit and punishes inefficiency. It maintains that the market delivers benefits that could never be achieved by planning. Attempts to limit competition are treated as inimical to liberty. Tax and regulation should be minimized. Public services should be privatized. The organization of labor and collective bargaining by trade unions are portrayed as market distortions that impede the formation of a natural hierarchy of winners and losers. Inequality is recast as virtuous, a reward for utility and a generator of wealth, which trickles down to enrich everyone. Efforts to create a more equal society are both counterproductive and morally corrosive. The market ensures that everyone gets what they deserve. That's the perfect idea. We internalize and reproduce its creeds. And it goes like this. The rich persuade themselves that they acquired their wealth through merit, ignoring the advantages such as education, inheritance, and class that may have helped to secure it. And then the poor begin to blame themselves for their failures, even when they can do little to change their circumstances. In a world governed by competition, those who fall behind become defined and self-defined as losers. There was a time where if you inherited your wealth, lucky you, but you were not looked up to, and you most certainly were not looked at as somebody who's doing hard work. You inherited your wealth. You didn't earn it. You inherited it. But now, folks who inherit their wealth, such as Donald Trump, who's never done a hard day's work in his entire life, is seen as a brilliant businessman. The lucky sperm club. You're not brilliant. You came out of the right sexual parts. You're not brilliant, but it doesn't matter. Neoliberalism now says that folks like him and him are brilliant. The term neoliberalism was coined at a meeting in Paris in 1938. Among the delegates were two men who came to define the ideology, and this is very important, Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, both exiles from Austria. They saw social democracy exemplified by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and the gradual development of Britain's welfare state as manifestations of collectivism and that occupied the same spectrum as Nazism and communism. In The Road to Serfdom, which was published in 1944, Hayek argued that government planning by crushing individualism would lead inexorably to totalitarian control. Like Mises' book, Bureaucracy, The Road to Serfdom was widely read. It came to the attention of some very wealthy people who saw in the philosophy an opportunity to free themselves of regulation and tax. Not you or I, but very wealthy people. In 1947, Hayek founded the first organization that would spread the doctrine of neoliberalism, the Mont Pelerin Society. It was financially supported by millionaires and their foundations. The movement's rich bankers funded a series of think tanks which would redefine and promote the ideology. Among them were the American Enterprise Institute, and you can Google all these. These are still around today. The Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Institute for Economic Affairs, the Center for Policy Studies, and the Adam Smith Institute. They all sound very official, very thinky-tanky, right? But these are merely tools that neoliberals use to convince us that trickle-down economics or neoliberalism works. They also financed academic positions and departments, particularly at the universities of Chicago and Virginia. And that's how we get the Chicago Boys School of Economics. Hayek's view that government should regulate competition to prevent monopolies from forming gave way among American apostles such as Milton Friedman to the belief that monopoly power could be seen as a reward for efficiency. So initially, neoliberalism was led by the idea of competition. Then came the Chicago Boys School of Economics, which brought us Milton Friedman. And that's where we began to see monopoly as a reward for efficiency rather than what it is, which is completely anti-competitive. I myself am really more of a Keynesian. John Maynard Key's economic ideas are really a lot closer to mine. John Maynard Key's economic prescriptions were widely applied. Full employment and the relief of poverty were common goals in the U.S. and much of Western Europe. Top tax rates were high, and government sought social outcomes without embarrassment, developing new public services and safety nets. But in the 1970s, when Keynesian policies began to fall apart and economic crises struck on both sides of the Atlantic, neoliberal ideas began to enter the mainstream again. They were adopted by Jimmy Carter's administration in the U.S., and they were adopted by Jim Callaghan's government in Britain. Then came Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And this is about the time that the term neoliberal dropped off the face of the map. You say it now and nobody knows what you're talking about. They might even think you're talking about liberals, such as myself. But we're not. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan took power. Soon after, massive tax cuts for the rich, the crushing of trade unions, deregulation, privatization, outsourcing, and competition in public services. Through the IMF, the World Bank, the Maastricht Treaty, and the World Trade Organization, neoliberal policies were imposed, often without democratic consent.
It is a regressive tax, so it's very, very dangerous in that thing, and it will raise more revenues. But the gentleman asked the question, he didn't even ask what we're talking about. He asked the question, what are you going to replace the income tax with? And I say, nothing. That's what we should replace it with.
And here's how we got the conservative idea of freedom, which is freedom for the pike, not for the minnows. Quote here, freedom from trade unions and collective bargaining means the freedom to suppress wages. Freedom from regulation means the freedom to poison rivers, endanger workers, charge iniquitous rates of interest, and design exotic financial instruments. Freedom from tax means freedom for the distribution of wealth that lifts people out of poverty. And when we take a public service, and we know this from recent history, when we take a public service and try to privatize it so that we can maximize the profit in it, we know exactly what happens.
This is not a lead issue. This is not even an infrastructure issue. This was a decision made by a Republican governor to give the rich in Michigan a $1 billion tax break. And then when they had $1 billion less dollars in the budget, it was like, okay, what are we going to do? We got to cut back on services. Anybody got any ideas? Yeah, let's take Flint off the drinking water from the Great Lakes and make them drink from the Flint River, so we could save money. Within a few months, they realized they were poisoning people, and the word came down, don't say anything, doctor the books, and they let people continue to drink this water and did nothing about it. And I think that is a crime, and they did it. I know they did it because it's a black city. It's a poor city. They wouldn't do this to Bloomfield Hills or Ann Arbor or Grosse Pointe. This was a hate crime. It was a hate crime based on this race hatred. They went another 9 months hoping nobody would pay any attention because, oh, these are just a bunch of black people, poor people. They have no lobbyists. They have no money in this.
Even President Barack Obama, a man that I cast a ballot for twice, is now on the world stage and is pushing TPP, which really is just another trade deal that is not going to help any of us. And I still ask myself to this very day, Mr. President, these trade deals have never, ever, ever helped out regular people. And don't tell me, well, then you must regret voting for that dang old Barack Obama. No, no. Considering the alternative, no. But this is one place where I disagree with them. Don't tell me that a conservative administration would not be pushing this as well. NAFTA, back in the 90s, conservatives love to say, Bill Clinton signed that. And he did. He did sign NAFTA. But you know who passed it? A majority of Republicans in Congress.
Mr. President, the United States is in the final stages of negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a massive free trade agreement with Mexico, Canada, Japan, Singapore, and 7 other countries. And I come to the floor today to ask a fundamental question. Who will benefit from the TPP? American workers, consumers, small businesses, taxpayers, or the biggest multinational corporations in the world? One strong hit is buried down in the fine print of the closely guarded draft. The provision, an increasingly common feature of international trade agreements, is called Investor Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. Now, the name may sound mild, but this provision fundamentally tilts the playing field further in favor of big multinational corporations. Worse yet, it undermines U.S. sovereignty. ISDS allows foreign companies to challenge American laws and potentially pick up huge payouts from taxpayers without ever stepping foot in an American court. Now, here's how it works. Imagine that the United States bans a toxic chemical that is often added to gasoline. We ban it because we believe it is dangerous for people's health or harmful to the environment. If a foreign company that makes this toxic chemical wants to sell it in the U.S., it would normally have to challenge that in a U.S. court. But with ISDS, the company could skip the U.S. court and go before an international panel of arbitrators. If the company wins, the ruling cannot be challenged in U.S. courts, and the arbitration panel could require the American taxpayers to cough up millions, even billions of dollars in damages.
You want to know how we end up with drywall that makes people sick? Well, because China could sue us if we ban it. You want to know how we, in America, can say you have to use dolphin-safe nets in order to catch tuna. And if you're going to sell tuna in America, you have to use those same nets in your country. That's why we got sued by Mexico, because they didn't want to use those. With the Keystone XL pipeline, we said no. You do not get to drag your pipeline across our country, putting us at risk and giving us none of the benefit. And now we're being sued by Canada. You want to know how we have these hoverboards that catch fire, and nobody knows what to do about it. Nobody understands how this can happen. How this gross negligence with respect to safety can happen. What are we going to do? We're going to tell China that they can't sell them here? No, we don't get to do that, because they could sue us for the loss of potential profits. Quoted from the article here, Chris Hedges remarks that fascist movements build their base not from the politically active, but the politically inactive. The losers, who feel, often correctly, they have no voice or role to play in the political establishment. When political debate no longer speaks to us, people have become responsive instead to slogans, symbols, and sensation. To the admirers of Trump, for example, facts and arguments appear irrelevant. Like communism, neoliberalism is the god that failed. And even wealthy people are beginning to realize, those of course who have a conscience, are beginning to realize that neoliberalism is a failure.
They are consumers, and the government is telling them that everything will be all right if we grow the economy, and the way to do that is keep consuming. So as long as they're consuming, things will look great, but at some point they don't have a savings account. They don't have an employer that they can count on to keep them in a health care plan or saving. In my day, boy, when a guy worked for Bud Webster Chevrolet and Cody, he was there for 50 years. Or if you worked for, you know, the Burlington Railroad, I mean, you were there. You nowadays, there's no security for them. 401ks, half of them won't do it anymore. But there's no savings at all. And when they get to a savings, they see the media, the ads. Look at these ads. This isn't how to buy a Ford car. It's how to buy a Lexus or an Esplanade or a whatever, a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 crate. And I thought, a lot of people watching this are minorities and poor people. No wonder they're pissed off. They're saying, I couldn't buy one of those. But I like to watch the football game. It's a sad... I think the class warfare thing is going to get worse and worse. The income inequality, worse and worse. This business of the minimum wage, oh, you can't afford $15. Well, then don't publish your quarterly report saying you made $1.5 billion. Give me a break, you know. There's really such hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is the original sin.
That's Alan Simpson, he of the Simpson-Bowles bill, pointing out how you can't say that you cannot afford to pay people a living wage when you yourself are raking in billions of dollars. Quoted from the article here, the invisible doctrine of the invisible hand, and that's what they call it, the invisible hand, is promoted by invisible backers. We find that the Institute of Economic Affairs, which has argued forcefully in the media against the further regulation of the tobacco industry, has been secretly funded by British American Tobacco since 1963. We also discover that Charles and David Koch founded the institute that set up the Tea Party movement, the supposed grassroots Tea Party movement. We find that Charles Koch, in establishing one of his think tanks, noted, in order to avoid undesirable criticism, how the organization is controlled and directed should not be widely advertised. What the market wants tends to mean what corporations and their bosses want. This model ensures that workers do not know for whom they toil.
And we begin at 6 with the outrage over Carrier moving Hoosier jobs to Mexico and the fight to save more jobs.
That fight on display today outside the State House. Hundreds of people protesting Carrier's decision to move to Monterrey. Their protest even drawing the support of a presidential candidate. And we have learned this. Carrier offered to stay if workers took an enormous pay cut. Call 6 Investigates Rafael Sanchez has tracked this story all the way to Mexico and back and was at that rally today. Rafael?
Erica and Todd, good evening. Talk about another bombshell. The first one, the jobs moving to Mexico. The second one today, we learn that Carrier would have considered staying if the workers at the Westside plant would accept $5.85 an hour with no benefits.
$5.85 an hour. Look here, Americans. It costs us less than $5 an hour to make Carrier units down in Mexico. And if you don't accept that, We're just going to go ahead and leave. Oh, and by the way, these trade deals that we've passed, they ensure that we can send our stuff in here. And if you don't let us send our cheaply made goods into America, we'll just sue the hell out of you. From the article, the anonymity of neoliberalism is fiercely guarded. Those who are influenced by Hayek, Mises, and Friedman tend to reject the term with some justice that is used today only pejoratively, referring to the term neoliberal. But they offer us no substitute. Some describe themselves as classic liberals or libertarians. So when you hear the phrase classic liberal, that's neoliberal. Or libertarian, that's neoliberal. And more millennials are beginning to identify themselves as libertarian, and I don't think they understand what they're in for. Neoliberalism's triumph also reflects the failure of the left. When laissez-faire economics led to catastrophe in 1929, Keynes devised a comprehensive economic theory to replace it. When Keynesian demand management hit the buffers in the 70s, there was no alternative ready. But when neoliberalism fell apart in 2008, there was nothing. This is why the zombie continues to walk. The left and center have produced no new general framework of economic thought for 80 years. But the neoliberals have been on the front lines.
He expressed dismay with Carrier's parent company, Connecticut-based United Technologies, because on one hand, he says, they take millions in military contracts, and on the other hand, they abandon the American workers in Huntington and Indianapolis who've made them a lot of money.
This company has failed and betrayed its own workers. It has betrayed the consumers of this country who buy their products. And all that it is motivated by, this is what United Technologies is about, is how can we make as much profit as we possibly can.
Conservative media outlets continue to push the idea that, you know what, there's lots of work out there. Americans are just lazy. And you know what? It's the left's fault. And I will concede that the left has not been as loud, or certainly hasn't gotten as much notice as conservatives have gotten with their terrible ideas. When neoliberalism is discussed on NBC and ABC and CBS and Fox and MSNBC and CNN, when it's discussed on all of these outlets, rarely is it ever challenged. And there's a reason for that. Because they need access to these people. The neoliberals hold the power right now. Yeah, they have some very terrible ideas that are sinking the American dream. But they have been put in charge right now. And neoliberalism is still seen. Tax cuts, privatization, those are still seen as the way forward, even though they've never done us any good. And then they look to us when we can't afford the rent. Look at us when we can't afford food. And they say, get off your ass and get out there and go to work. Blaming the victims.
We're staying home. More people are staying home, millennially speaking, than actually moving out for the first time in history, really. Why? Number one, the economy doesn't have the jobs for these people, right? So the bottom line is everybody would like to live on their own. These kids are high. They're high on pot. They're high on Facebook. They're high on Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat. So they can't be bothered to cobble together three jobs. They're very busy.
I don't think that many kids are using pot, are they?
They are. You know what? As these states legalize pot, it's everybody and his sister and his brother who's coming in for a medical marijuana license. Now it's going to be recreational. That's the Obama America. Get high, stay home, don't be autonomous.
And then you dumb millennials who have begun identifying yourselves as libertarians because you see it as a form of freedom, if you turn to a more libertarian outfit, a more neoliberal outlet, they are slamming you as the lazy ones. You who identify yourself with their ideology, they're slamming you for the fact that you can't find work. You. For the fact that you can't get your wages raised. You, for the fact that you can't afford food or rent. They're blaming you. And you, dummy, are still identifying yourself as a libertarian.
Why do you think we're entering a, what does it say? We don't want no stinking socialism. What does that mean?
It's just like kind of taking away our freedoms and more government than we really need.
Which freedoms?
our freedom of speech, I think.
Freedom of speech?
All right. 15 minutes.
How is that happening?
Everybody, if your vehicle's out there, please move it.
What bill did they
do? I don't know.
Do you see this on the regular TV?
No.
TV channel?
They're all biased.
So, freedom of speech. What other freedoms?
So many of her freedoms are being taken away that she can't even name them all. A necessitous man is not a free man. When I say that, I don't mean gender. I mean people. Necessitous people are not free people. And when you say that your freedoms are being taken away from you, are they being taken away or are you willingly giving them up? And completely unable to recognize the hand that holds you down because it's completely anonymous. And then you start to see the government, which, by the way, is the only way you have power in a society as large as ours. We're not tribal anymore. We have to have a way to come together to get the things that we want. And so we do. And we call it government. And then you get out there on the front lines of these protests. And you argue against the only way, the only thing that you have for power. See, the neoliberal idea that you're going to influence the world with the money that you spend or do not spend is never going to work. Only people who have a lot of money get to influence that way. That's why the Kochs are spending so much money. That's why these bankers and Wall Street folks are spending so much money. And that's why they want to remain anonymous. Because that gives them more power. And instead of you blaming them, who's influencing government policy, you blame yourself. You blame government. This from Common Dreams, the president of Ecuador. Quote, it's neoliberalism, not socialism, that has failed. Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa denounced fantasies of trickle-down theories and has said that it is neoliberalism, not socialism, that has failed his region. Correa also said inequality in a poor country means misery and added that only the pursuit of the kind of growth that favors the poor, growth with social justice, growth with equity, was important. A 2013 paper from the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that financial reforms carried out by Korea's administration, such as the government's taking control of central bank and increased taxation of the financial sector, helped the country make economic progress. Quote, Ecuador has gone against the conventional wisdom and shown that there are alternatives. CEPR co-director Mark Weisbrot and the lead author of the paper said at the time, by pursuing policies that have prioritized economic development, employment, and poverty reduction over financial and foreign interests, Ecuador has surmounted some of the problems that had previously held it back and that have hampered progress in other countries. And another person begins to see the light.
Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders wants America to be a socialist country, and even liberals are blasting his agenda. My next guest says socialism is a violation of basic human rights. Thor Halvorsen of the Human Rights Foundation joins me now with details. Thor, why do you believe socialism is a violation of basic human rights?
Well, let's actually qualify that. Countries that do not violate human rights can have socialist governments, and that's perfectly okay. If there are branches of government that exist and separation of powers and constitutional rights, you can have a country like Denmark or Norway or Sweden that's oftentimes have socialist governments, labor governments. That's perfectly fine. The problem is when socialism is done under an authoritarian government or someone using socialism as a mask, takes control of a government, claims that they're going to help the people and ultimately end up looting the country and
all
ruining
right.
it.
Let's try
but I will say this. I actually made the largest contribution allowable to the campaign of Bernie Sanders. I made a contribution to Bernie Sanders'
really?
Campaign. Yes. I believe the
Why?
Democrat, because the Democratic frontrunner right now is unfortunately someone who has taken millions and millions of dollars from many dictatorships. Algeria, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, Saudi Arabia, countries that execute people for being gay, countries that restrict all press freedoms, countries that in some cases ban Christmas. I would much rather have Bernie Sanders be the Democratic
wow.
frontrunner than a person who takes money from dictatorships, unquestionably. And at the same time, on the Republican side, you have the frontrunner who believes that
Putin
is fine. And that is awful as well.
That was Trish Regan on Fox News, who brought this guy on hoping that he would just slam the hell out of socialism. And then he went, nope, no, oh man, no. Now, I just gave a whole bunch of money to Bernie Sanders. This happened a number of months back. And so the the talking point right now. We gotta stop these damn illegals from coming in here and taking our jobs. And we know that that's not true. We know that that's not what's happening. No one's coming in and taking a job. It is being given to them by corrupt employers. And the problem with building a wall 20, 30, 90,000 feet higher, whatever the hell you want to do, across the entire southern border, isn't going to do anything. Because all it takes is a shovel and a little bit of time, and you're under the wall. The easiest way across. It is if somebody really wants to come across. So what you need to do is start going after the employers that hire these people illegally, that exploit these workers. And for all of the talk right now from conservatives, from Donald Trump, that they're going to do something about these people coming in and taking your jobs and ruining your life. In Congress right now, they're trying to ensure that more and more of these guest workers, they call them, can come in. This from the editorial board of the New York Times from back in July. So far this year, employers in the United States have hired some 80,000 foreign guest workers for low-skilled non-agricultural jobs. If a bipartisan group in Congress, that means both parties, gets its way, that number could soon rise as high as 264,000. This is happening inside of a presidential year where we are so anti-immigrant, it's disgusting. Quote, employers say they need to import these workers, called H-2B workers, after their visa category because no comparable American workers are available. But this claim does not stand up. When labor is scarce, unemployment falls and wages rise. But unemployment is high in all of the top H-2B fields, which include landscaping, groundskeeping, construction, hospitality, seafood processing, while wages in those fields have long been flat or declining. So if you need people in those fields, you're going to have to raise the wages. No. Why? Well, because it's a lot easier to exploit a guest worker, even if there were a labor shortage. The H-2B system would not be an acceptable solution. The Government Accountability Office has found that H-2B workers who typically work for 9-month stints have been abused. News reports support these findings. These workers are yoked to their employers if they protest unsafe conditions, wage theft, or other mistreatment. They risk dismissal, deportation, and financial ruin. Why would Congress expand the H-2B system? Because businesses that profit from cheap and subservient labor are demanding that it do so. The same employers that are also funding Donald Trump, who's saying he's going to get them the hell out of here, all 11 million of them. Employers are supposed to recruit American workers before they hire H-2B workers. They're supposed to pay guest workers the prevailing wage Americans would earn. Legal loopholes and lax enforcement have allowed them to step aside those rules. In April of last year, federal regulators issued tough new rules to monitor recruitment and ensure fair pay. The backlash was swift. Later in 2015, in a rider's to a budget bill, the new rule on fair pay was undone. The annual cap on H-2B visas was effectively quadrupled from 66,000, and the Labor Department was denied funds to audit employer compliance with visa and labor laws. Budget riders normally expire at the end of a fiscal year, but lawmakers have now began to attach last year's H-2B riders to spending bills for the next year. So, they made it so they could bring in even more guest workers, and then they said the Labor Department can't do anything about it. That was written into the bill. Does this sound like a group of people that is really concerned about your labor needs, that is really concerned about making sure that these people don't come in and take your jobs? No, they're not. They're playing both sides of this. They're bringing in these illegal workers, and they're funding Donald Trump, who's saying that he's not going to bring these workers in, that he's actually going to get all 11 million of them out of here, and then we're just going to be a utopia at that time.
They're so paranoid. Michelle Bachmann said these illegal immigrants, she said, they're going to be voting. Okay, there's no evidence of illegal immigrants ever voting, although they should. There's another job Americans won't do.
These crooked employers are also working to reduce the fines that they would have to pay if somebody dies on the job. Here's what you have to understand. You are cheap. And you are expendable, and you mean nothing to a lot of these large employers especially. And the cheaper you are, the better. And if you die early, that's great by them. They will go out and they will get another worker who will work for less. Or if you start making too much money or start demanding good wages, they'll simply fire you. Hopefully, you don't belong to a union to them. And they will simply go get somebody. You mean nothing to these large employers. And a lot of folks are great with that. I hear it all the time, arguing against labor unions. I hear people who are not making very much money arguing that we should not be paying a living wage to American workers in the city of Portland right now. A report that just came out said that the median home price is $350,000. $350,000. They said, in order to afford a home in Portland, you, as an individual, need to be making $71,000 a year in order to live comfortably. Now, if you take the old math and you cut that in half, so that means you need to be making $35 an hour. They recently raised the wages in Portland to $15 an hour, and it was almost people burning buildings to the ground. No, you can't do that. You're going to kill business. $15 an hour isn't even enough to survive in Portland. You're going to have to get several jobs. Quoting from the District Sentinel here by Sam Sachs, average workplace safety fine less than the cost of a funeral of a dead worker. More than 30,000 employees have died at work since President Obama took office in 2009, according to a study released by the nonprofit Center for Progressive Reform. The group blamed the high number of deaths on the low cost of noncompliance, finding the median OSHA penalty imposed on the employers to only be $5,800, less than the cost of an average funeral and far less than is necessary for penalties to have a genuine deterrent effect on companies tempted to skirt worker safety rules. CPR noted in its report entitled OSHA's Discount on Danger. The group said meager punishments were the result of statutory caps to prevent OSHA from fining a company more than $70,000 per violation. The agency published new maximum penalties that are scheduled to take effect soon. CPR also criticized OSHA for a routine practice of discounting its penalties. It said the agency reduces fines as a matter of practice rather than considering on a case-by-case basis whether a reduced penalty is warranted. Reductions are supposed to be based on factors like the size of the employer and a past history of violations.
Is income inequality a problem in this country? Is it a problem that Republicans want to address? It is. And frankly, the president's policies have made income inequality worse. All the regulations that are coming out of Washington make it more difficult for employers to hire more people. Chief amongst those, I would argue, is Obamacare, which basically puts a penalty or a tax on employers for every new job they create.
If you listen to conservatives talk, especially conservative congressmen, they will tell you that the president writes and passes all of the policy, not them, not Congress, it's the president. So, here's John Boehner on CBS selling neoliberalism to the people and showing that he, who worked for government, has absolutely no idea how government works. To say that the president's policies, which by the way, Boehner, you've been in charge just about the whole time, to say that it's the president's policies when it's you and Mitch McConnell there in the House and Senate passing these things, there's a complete disconnect there. But that's what they have to do in order to continue selling neoliberalism. This from Richard D. Wolff in a Truth Out interview. Americans associate capitalism with freedom. Richard Wolff, capitalism usually overthrew its predecessor system, often feudalism, sometimes slavery or others, violently and accompanied by slogans of freedom, as in the French Revolution's Liberté, Égalité, and Fraternité, Emancipation Proclamation, so on, so on. Capitalism represented itself as freeing serfs and slaves. Freedom became capitalism's self-celebration, which it largely remains. Yet the reality of capitalism is different from its celebratory self-image. The mass of employees are not free inside of the capitalist enterprises to participate in the decisions that affect their lives, e.g. what the enterprise will produce, the technology it will use, when production will occur, and what will be done if with the profit workers help produce. In their exclusion from such decisions, modern capitalism's employees resemble slaves and serfs. Yes, parliaments, universal suffrage, etc. have accompanied capitalism, an advance over serfdom and slavery. Yet even that advance has been largely undermined by the influence of the highly unequally distributed wealth and income that capitalism has everywhere generated. In the last 30 years, the mass of Americans have seen stagnant real wages even as labor productivity rose steadily. Losses of job benefits and security reduced public services and a political system increasingly corrupted and compromised by inequalities of wealth and income. Incremental changes in capitalism and Wall Street accompanied every step of these declines for most Americans. Promises that those incremental changes would work for the benefit of most Americans have proven to be false. To believe them now is to have learned nothing from the last 35 years of this nation's history. Poverty has always accompanied capitalism. Uncool. I would like to add to that, poverty has always accompanied laissez-faire, unregulated capitalism. And now, it's not just a threat to us in our everyday lives, it's a threat to democracy.
We are so close to losing our democracy to the mercenary class, it's as if we're leaning way over the rim of the Grand Canyon, and all that's needed is a swift kick in the pants. Look out below. The predators in Washington are only this far from monopoly control of our government. They've bought the political system, lock, stock, and pork barrel, making change from within impossible. That's the real joke. Sometimes I long for the wit of a John Stewart or Stephen Colbert. They treat this town as burlesque, and with satire and parody, show it the disrespect it deserves. We laugh and punch each other on the arm and tweet that the rascals got their just dessert. But the last laugh always seems to go to the bold-faced names that populate this town. To them belong the spoils of a looted city. They get the tax breaks, the loopholes, the contracts, the payoffs. They fix the system so multimillionaire hedge fund managers and private equity tycoons pay less of a tax rate on their income than school teachers, police and firefighters, secretaries and janitors. They give subsidies to rich corporate farms and cut food stamps for working people facing hunger. They remove oversight of the Wall Street casinos, bail out the bankers who torpedo the economy, fight the modest reforms of Dodd-Frank, prolong tax havens for multinationals, and stick it to consumers while rewarding corporations. We pay. We pay at the grocery store. We pay at the gas pump. We pay the taxes they write off. Our low-wage workers pay with sweat and deprivation because this town, aloof, self-obsessed, bought off, and doing very well, thank you, feels no pain. The journalists who could tell us these things rarely do, and some never. They aren't blind, simply bedazzled. Watch the evening news, any evening news, or the Sunday talk shows. Listen to the chit-chat of the early risers on morning TV, and ask yourself if you're learning anything about how this town actually works. William Grider, one of our craft's finest reporters, fierce and unbought despite a long life in Washington, once said that no one can hope to understand what is driving political behavior without asking the kind of gut-level questions politicians ask themselves in private. Who are the winners in this matter, and who are the losers? Who gets the money, and who has to pay? Who must be heard on this question, and who can be safely ignored? Perhaps they don't ask these questions because they fear banishment from the parties and perks from the access that passes as seduction in this town. Or perhaps they don't tell us these things because they fear that if the system were exposed for what it is, outraged citizens would descend on this town and tear it apart with their bare hands.
Every great religion in the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, essentially comes down to do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. And what I have believed in my whole life, I believed it when I was a two-year-old kid getting arrested in Chicago fighting segregation. I believed it in my whole life, that we are in this together, not just not words. The truth is, at some level, when you hurt, when your children hurt, I hurt. I hurt. And when my kids hurt, you hurt. And it's very easy to turn our backs on kids who are hungry or veterans who are sleeping out on the street. And we can develop a psyche, a psychology, which says, I don't have to worry about them. All I'm going to worry about myself. I need to make another $5 billion. But I believe that what human nature is about is that everybody in this room impacts everybody else in all kinds of ways that we can't even understand. It's beyond intellect.
As the old saying goes, and I'm paraphrasing here, there's enough for every man's need, but there is not enough for every man's greed. When we embrace neoliberal ideas, we fail to embrace the ideas of any sort of society or collectivism. But that, of course, was the point. When it came to Thatcher, when it came to Reagan, when it comes to the modern Republican Party, and to a lesser degree, the modern Democratic Party. Neoliberalism is the way, and that is where we stop caring about each other. There are some folks who have it all. Cars, gigantic homes, expensive jewelry, and they want for nothing. They also have a lot of food. Whenever we look at poor neighborhoods and we see fat people, I hear a lot of conservatives say, if they're starving, why are they so fat? Well, there's a couple of things that can lead to obesity. One of them is overeating, and one of them is poor nutrition. Heavily processed foods, a lot of excess and added sugars, a lot of breads, things of that nature can make you overweight as well. Not getting the right nutrients can also make you overweight. And lack of access to resources. This by Alex Orlov over at The Mic from back in May. The world would not exist if everyone ate like Americans. Quote here, more than one-third of the nation's adults are obese and the kids aren't far behind. If the rest of the world mimicked America's food habits, the world might be all dried up. The planet would have run out of water 16 years ago. Now remember, the planet is mostly made of water. But the way we consume it for food production, if the rest of the world produced food like America does, according to this report, it would have run out of water 16 years ago. Mother Jones reported this, as America's demand for meat is incredibly taxing on the water supply. A no longer secret report released by WikiLeaks revealed that the international food giant Nestle has big concerns about countries chowing down on as much meat as Americans. The report called our future potentially catastrophic if Chinese and Indian people begin eating more chicken, beef, and pork. Gallons of water go into support of the crops that feed the animals that we eat. We feed food to our food. In the report, Nestle assessed that a calorie of meat requires 10 times as much water as a calorie of produce and grains. If the whole world were to chow down like us, global freshwater resources would be exhausted at a population level of 6 billion. We're almost 7 billion now. We reached 6 billion in the year 2000. That's why they say it would have run out of fresh water 16 years ago. How to make a difference? The key is not necessarily swearing off meat for good. Just one meatless meal can save 140 gallons of water and the same amount of greenhouse gases that you would create from driving a car 6 miles. Committing to a certain number of vegetarian meals, even just one a week, would have a huge impact. Calculate the potential earth-saving benefits of your meatless meals with this nifty calculator, which you can find over on Morningstar Farms' website. And even with that, even with the amount of food that we produce and have all these overweight Americans, we still have a lot of what are referred to as food deserts, where people don't have access to fresh food. We also have a lot of food insecurity, where in a supposedly Christian nation, we have a lot of people that go to bed hungry every night. And thanks to a lot of neoliberal ideas, the programs that we would have that would take care of the lesser in our society, the less advantaged in our society, well, those programs are at risk of being cut, mostly by Republicans.
Millions of families in this country where the breadwinner is making 8, 9, 10 bucks an hour can't afford to feed their families adequately. Republican budget cut nutrition programs, including the program for low-income pregnant women and their babies, by many, many billions of dollars. And then to add insult to injury, to tell you really what the priorities are of the Republican Party is, after cutting health care and education and nutrition, they provided over $250 billion in tax breaks to the top 0.2%.
Quoting here from Truth Out by Mark Carlin, when hunger and poverty persist in the U.S., half of edible food is being thrown away. In 2014, 14% of households, that's over 17 million households, were food insecure. In 2014, 5.6% of U.S. households, that's 6.9, had low food security. In 2014, 47 million people lived in poverty. This means the poverty rate for 2014 was 15%. The 2014 poverty rate was 2.3 percentage points higher than in 2007, this the year before the 2008 recession. This comes from the land of plenty, as the U.S. is known. According to this article, half of all the produce grown and processed in the U.S. is never eaten. There are a variety of reasons for this, past date, food thrown out at supermarkets, to restaurant weight, to food simply rotting in storage. One of the most startling reasons that a significant portion of the U.S. food is thrown away is it does not meet the cosmetic standard of consumers as assessed by growers, wholesale sellers, and retail merchants. Americans throw away as much food as they eat because of a cult of perfection. Vast quantities of fresh produce grown in the U.S. are left in the field to rot, fed to livestock, or hauled directly from field to landfill because of unrealistic and unyielding cosmetic standards, according to official data and interviews with dozens of farmers, packers, truckers, researchers, campaigners, and government officials. And this is how we're taking care of people in a supposed Christian nation.
A lot of our far right-wing friends like to worship Jesus as a god because that's a whole lot easier than having to follow his extremely liberal teachings. And Jesus, as far as we know, didn't care one bit about who believes in talking snakes. Jesus mentions talking snakes as often as he mentions gay people, premarital sex, and abortion, which is to say, never. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus does state his priorities in a parable. He talks about separating the flock, the sheep from the goats, and he thanks the sheep for feeding him, for welcoming him even though he was a stranger, clothing him when he was poor, taking care of him when he was sick, and caring for him when he was in prison. The goats, safe to assume he means the fake Christians, all say, well, Jesus, when were you poor and hungry and sick and in prison? And Christ replies, when you didn't do it for the least of my people, you didn't do it for me. And that's what Christianity was supposed to be about. Not calling the poor lazy, justifying torture, not fighting for tax cuts for the wealthiest Nazarenes, not asking lepers for a bigger copay, and not teaching kids to ignore science so they can believe in a talking snake. A more plausible theory is that literal creationism is Satan's nifty little plot to make Christians look very silly.
There's an article by Mark Sandlin over at Pathos called 10 Things You Cannot Vote For While Following Jesus. First of all, anti-LGBT laws. Ask yourself, who would Jesus discriminate against? As you think about the answer, keep in mind that while the Pharisees encouraged discrimination against women, tax collectors, the poor, and even Samaritans, Jesus went out of his way to radically include them all. Turning away immigrants. Christian heritage runs through Judaism. We are all immigrant people. Even our religion began in other lands. Letting people go hungry. Politically, hunger causes problems with education, production, and civil behavior, which are all necessary for a successful nation. More importantly for Christians, Jesus said that when we feed the hungry, we are feeding him. Four, favoring the rich over the poor. Favoring the rich over the poor is a slap in the face to Jesus, his life, and his teachings. And it's weird to me that we have In God We Trust on our money, advocating for war. Number five, there's a reason why Jesus was called the Prince of Peace. Sure, you can quote, I did not bring peace, but a sword, and even two or three other verses, but they can't hold a candle to the more than 50-some verses where Jesus speaks about peace and peacemaking. Most of all, Jesus' teachings come back to one thing, teaching love. And that's a lot. That's far away from killing somebody. Six, limiting access to health care. When people who were sick needed care, Jesus gave it to them. If you're following Jesus, we will intimidate him as closely as possible. No, the government can't repeat the miracles he did, but in modern medicine, he can do things, we can do things that are about as close to a miracle as we can get. Every year, 20,000 to 45,000 people die in the U.S. because of lack of access to health care. 7, devalue in education. We learn in Proverbs that wisdom is something in which God delights daily. As a matter of fact, according to Proverbs, wisdom is better than gold. 8, supporting capital punishment. Execution. Jesus died by execution and he was an innocent man. Every year, innocent people die by execution in our nation, forcing your religion upon others. One of the strengths of the faith Jesus taught us about was its meekness. The faith he taught valued free will over compulsion because that's how love works. Compelling people to follow your religion, more or less your personal religion, stands over and against the way Jesus practiced his faith. If you are using government to compel people to practice your spiritual beliefs, you might be the reason that baby Jesus is crying. And number 10, Donald Trump. Why can't you follow Donald Trump and be a good Christian? See 1 through 9. Most of the neoliberal ideas that are followed and put into law by conservatives come from Ayn Rand, who was not a Christian, who, by the way, hated Christianity. And yet, you will find many of your conservative lawmakers emulating her ideas and writing them into our nation's laws. This from an interview with CBS back in the 60s.
You are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes.
Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then she is beyond, he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond.
There are very few of us, then, in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few.
You cannot argue for war. You cannot argue for capital punishment. You cannot argue for lack of access to health care. You cannot argue for food deserts. And you can't and still call yourself a Christian or to say that this is a Christian nation when folks are going to bed hungry. You cannot say that this is a Christian nation when we are perpetually waging war against countries not for the purpose that we state before we go into war, but in order to make American corporations rich. You are not a Christian, and we are not a Christian nation, not as long as we are killing people, whether that be our own citizens, whether that be the citizens of other countries, and not while our children are going to bed hungry, not while our people lack access to health care, and not while we are producing food, more than enough food to feed everybody, and yet somehow, our people do not have enough to eat and do not have access to good food. Neoliberalism is the idea that is being practiced in America. And it is destroying us. And it is time we learn the word. It is time we use it in public. And it is time that we begin to decry it for what it is. It's a scam. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can also find us on Kiwi Station. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail are just a general statement of inquiry. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. My name is Melvin. Fire your hate mail in this direction. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Yo. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. And now that I have woken you up, good morning.